Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Today our special guest is Carolina Reed. Carolina joined the Center for Responsible Lending in August 2011 as a senior researcher working out of the center's California office. Before coming to CRL, Carolina served as the research manager for the Community Development Department of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. At the Fed, published a substantial number of journal articles, working papers, and policy reports on the Community Reinvestment Act, the foreclosure crisis, access to credit, the role of anti-predatory lending laws. She also helped build the capacity of local stakeholders, including banks, nonprofits, and local governments, to undertake community development activities. Carolina, welcome to our show.
Thank you. Thanks, Bruce, and thanks so much for having me.
I'm going to start by reading a statement that was in one of the three or four reports that I read, but it sort of kind of deepened the meaning of your most recent report, Lost Ground. And the quote is, "For decades, owning a home has been the most accessible way to build wealth and gain a foothold in the middle class, especially for lower income and or middle income borrowers of color. This crisis threatens to undo decades of social, economic, and educational progress." So whoever thought up the title Lost Ground actually chose a pretty meaningful title, it seems.
They did, and it was also a little bit of a play on a previous report that Center for Responsible Lending published called Losing Ground, where they predicted the scale of the foreclosure crisis related to subprime lending. And sort of, you know, 5 years into the crisis, we thought it would be interesting to sort of revisit that and see what we know now.
And what do we know?
Well, we know that we're only about halfway through the crisis, which was a surprise to us in terms of how many borrowers are still delinquent or in some stage of the foreclosure process. And we know that although the majority of borrowers that have been affected have been white families as well as higher income or middle income families, a disproportionate share of the foreclosure crisis has fallen on communities of color.
And have you figured out why that is? Is it possible that the lending programs were an attempt to get the people that hadn't had a chance to own a home to own one, and that would have probably naturally been a higher percentage of families of color?
So we actually, in Lost Ground, which is the latest report that we've just put out, we look carefully at what led to the differential foreclosure rates among communities of color or borrowers of color. And we find that it's actually very closely tied to the loan products that they received. So it's not necessarily that we were lending to the wrong kinds of borrowers, rather that we were offering borrowers the wrong kinds of loan products. These loan products with risky features such as teaser adjustable interest rates and prepayment penalties, some of the option arms and negative amortization loans that were really common between the 2004 and sort of maybe 2007 lending period, really have much higher foreclosure rates than loans that are proven to build equity and wealth for families. The 30-year fixed rate mortgage.
Yeah, the normal products. But those were the years that probably that subprime product or all those creative loans probably had their peak. We buy foreclosures at the courthouse steps, and I would say still the majority, by maybe 60% or so, are 2 years of loans, 2006 and 2007.
So I should clarify that in the report that we just released, we're actually looking at loans only originated between 2004 and 2008.
Correct.
And, you know, sort of the height of the subprime lending boom.
And what total loans is that? Do you know how many loans that encompasses?
So the sample that we're working with is 27 million loans. So it's a large segment. It's a lot of loans. took a long time to run the data. And we also took special attention to try and make sure that the loans that we were representing had a wide coverage of the mortgage market. So we looked at both subprime and prime and Alt-A loans. So we sort of have broad market coverage in these results.
In the 2009 report, the untold cost of subprime lending, there was a very important question asked, I thought. It said, how did borrowers decide on which loan product to accept, and how knowledgeable were they about the loan terms? That was a question that wasn't answered in the 2009 report. Do you have an answer for that?
So we don't have very good answers. We know some things. We know that brokers, and with their incentive to steer borrowers into more expensive loans, that brokers had a big role in it. We're still not sure by the mechanisms by which certain borrowers went to brokers and others may not have gone to brokers. We know that these were complicated loans. We know that borrowers did not shop around for a mortgage the way we might shop around for other products and therefore sort of cost compare.
What?
And so that put them in a more vulnerable position to get a product that wasn't well suited to their circumstances, or that they were really sort of given a product that was much more expensive than the loan that they might have actually qualified for based on their credit score.
One of the things that I recall during that time frame is I couldn't get in the radio without hearing about a loan program. So it would seem like you would have been exposed to at least, you know, the teaser program on radio. You might have called on that and then, oh, I'm sorry, you don't qualify. So it would seem like you would know there was a shift in what you were going to be able to get. So I guess that was one of the things that confused me in a way. It just seemed like that there would have been a natural exposure to at least a competitive product, or people were dealing with people they felt so comfortable with that they had blind trust. And I have you ever done a study on that and who the loans were obtained from, and that there was so much trust they didn't realize that they were taking advantage of the spread premium, that type of thing?
So when I was at the Federal Reserve, I did do a study that used that interviewed borrowers to develop a better understanding of why different borrowers receive different kinds of loan products. And I should just state at the outset that, you know, all these views are my views, and they certainly don't reflect those of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco or the Federal Reserve System. And, you know, I'm relatively new to CRL, but, people did have a lot of trust in both brokers and lenders as being the professionals and trusted advisors who would put them into a responsible loan product, or at least a loan product that, you know, was well suited to their financial circumstances. And what the borrowers didn't understand was that these brokers had a financial incentive to actually steer them into a more expensive loan. And there wasn't much evidence of shopping around. And it's very different to hear a radio ad than to actually know, given your own financial circumstances, your own credit score, what you might qualify.
Mm-hmm.
I also think it's important to distinguish between lending programs that were sort of, you know, run through nonprofits and other sort of affordable homeownership programs where we've seen extremely low foreclosure rates, and the lending products that were being pushed by the private market over this time period.
I'd have to say it's probably the only time in history where the lender themselves probably didn't care if the loan was ever repaid, because they didn't own it very long. And that's an astonishing piece of history we probably will never get to relive.
Yeah, well, I think we hope not, right?
No.
It's clear that there wasn't much incentive to make responsible, safe loans over this time period, and it has had devastating consequences for borrowers.
Right, and that's across all categories of people. So, you know, that's one of the things about people that are losing their homes. Have you done any research on there's been a lot of them, something like 2.3 million people have already lost their home in foreclosure. What percentage of those people put a down payment down? Or what percentage of those people did a refinance and pulled money out, actually? Has there been any study about that?
So there has been other research about that. I don't know the percentages off the top of my head, and I haven't done that research myself.
Mm-hmm.
We did look at those same patterns within the data for Lost Ground, and we found that when we look at the patterns between people who put down a down payment and people who didn't put down a down payment, it doesn't make much difference in terms of who was marketed the most risky loan products and the relationship between those loan products and their ultimate sort of status at the end, whether or not they were in foreclosure or not. But certainly we know now that, you know, it's actually quite important to document somebody's income and assets as part of the loan underwriting process.
Well, and, you know, I think that's one of the things, you know, when we're talking about this, is that we realize there were different terms for the risky loans, higher interest and so forth. But that was because that the lenders were not documenting certain things. Getting back to my other question, what I'm really kind of getting at is a lot of the people that have lost their homes in foreclosure, I know that's not a pleasant process, and I'm not minimizing that, but I'm wondering how many people actually lost money, because I think that if we looked into it, and it might be something to look into, is that you'd find that a great many people didn't have a down payment, or they have now been in the home for 2 years not making a payment, or they extracted equity in the meantime. And I, you know, we're concentrating on a group of people that lost their property. There's a neighbor next door, and I'll give you just an example that could happen in Riverside where I live, where home values have declined by 50%. You could have somebody that borrowed $600,000 on a $600,000 home without a down payment. That was very easy to do. And let's say now they still owe $600,000 and the house is worth $300,000. And a next door neighbor put down 50% and owes $300,000 on a $300,000 house and has literally $300,000 of after tax dollars disappear from his life. And we don't talk about that group of people as being damaged in this process, but they have been probably more damaged in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the negative spillover effects of foreclosure on surrounding neighbors is huge, right, and on the market as a whole. And as you say, there's plenty of borrowers who are still in their homes and who have seen their equity erode and their sort of wealth erode in their homes. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why we're pushing so hard to try and stabilize the housing market through foreclosure prevention, just to stop all this sort of, you know, downward slide of house prices.
Well, you know, okay, and this is, I mentioned to you off air, there'd be some areas where we disagree, and I guess that would be one of them I would fundamentally disagree with. In stopping foreclosure, one of the things that we've done a very good job of so far, and that's why, you know, the first comment you made was that we're not halfway through this process, is because we've delayed on foreclosing. And so somebody that was foreclosed on, let's say, fairly quickly in 2008 is literally reemerging as a buyer in 2011 and 12 because the system allows them to rebuy in 3 years after a foreclosure and get an FHA loan. For this gigantic group of people who we have not even stopped the credit damage, they are not going to be buyers until something like 2015, 2016. So that's one of the problems, is the unintended consequences. Your market doesn't heal very fast when you prevent people from actually losing a property. But why do you think it's so important to stop foreclosures, and by what method would you do it?
So one of the reasons that I think that it's important to stop foreclosures is because of the negative spillover effects on neighborhoods, right? The neighborhoods that have been hit by the most foreclosures tend to be lower income neighborhoods. They tend to be neighborhoods with high concentrations of minority households. These were neighborhoods that, you know, were starting to improve and that we invested a lot in terms of community development, and now have hit, sort of really received a big shock. The community there has been really hard hit by this process. I think the other real reason is that there may be a few borrowers who are coming out of the foreclosure process and doing just fine a few years down the road, but I think most of the research shows that a financial shock like that can actually have devastating consequences, not only in terms of rebuilding their credit score, sort of regaining financial stability, and then more generally sort of the lost, you know, accumulation of wealth potential over this time period. So, you know, I'm not as sanguine as you are about sort of the fact that doing a foreclosure quickly is going to be the best thing for either borrowers or neighborhoods. Now, I agree that we can't prevent every foreclosure, but I think in a lot of cases, improved servicer practices would help encourage loan modifications for borrowers who can and do want to stay in their homes, And we have good evidence that effective loan modifications do reduce the risk of subsequent default. And I think that that's in everybody's interest, not only the borrower, but also the investor and the neighborhood.
Well, okay, once again, I'm going to disagree a little bit. But loan mods, let's talk about that. Track record, probably failure rate of over 50%, depending on when they were done. So if you created a loan product with a 50% failure rate, you wouldn't be calling that a success. But
I would like to disagree with that statistic around the failure rate, because those failure rates, or the redefault rates, were calculated on loan modifications that actually didn't necessarily reduce the payment or any sort of, it didn't actually help the borrower. And so it's not surprising that loan redefaulted. We find that loans that do actually reduce monthly payment, and particularly loans that help to reduce some principal burden.
Okay, that's what I wanted to get
excellent,
to.
an excellent sort of, don't go back into default very easily.
Okay. Well, then I knew we were going to come to that. That was what I was hoping we would come to. But the word in the document, and this is facing the foreclosure crisis Forager needs to address now, the word require servicers to make reasonable modifications, can that be translated to require loan principal reductions?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think that we all believe that principal reduction would go a long way to help stabilizing the mortgage market, or the housing market in general. I think, the fact that there's more conservative economists who are even calling for principal reduction, I think everybody sees that as sort of a necessary step. But I think in the require language there, and I didn't write that document, but I think the require language there more refers to making sure that servicers clean up their practices and pursue modifications more responsibly than they have in the past, and sort of eliminate abusive practices like dual tracking a modification at the same time as a foreclosure.
I would agree with that one, because that's actually very frustrating for us who buy properties at the courthouse steps. When you buy a property legitimately at the courthouse steps, I mean, that is a legitimate way to buy property. You go to the door and somebody's in shock because they were told they were working, they had a loan mod in progress. And that's pretty awkward for all of us, because, we're really not trying to short circuit the system. We're trying to make a living buying and rehabbing properties. And you have people that have been told one thing by one department and another department not even knowing the conversation occurred. That's wrong.
I agree. See, we could find some agreement.
Oh, of course. No. It's not a one size fits all. And this is an unprecedented event. And that is one thing that, if you know the history like you do, that I've been forced to understand as an investor, this is the Great Depression of at least real estate. If it isn't the Great Depression number two, it is for the industry that we are attached to. We've never had anything like this. And since the Great Depression, where prices have fallen not 5% a year, but 5% sometimes a month in the worst hit areas, until you could have a 50% equity cushion and have no cushion inside of 18 months. That's a ridiculous price dive. But one of the things that we have to be careful of is the unintended consequences of policies that a lender looks at and says, holy mackerel, I didn't know they could do that. But since I now know they can do that, my lending policies going forward will be certainly very different. Because I don't think your goal is to make the foreclosure rate zero in the future, because that would eliminate probably a lot of people from potential ownership that would, in fact, make a payment.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think one of the things that we've been doing research on here is to show that you don't have to return to an incredibly restrictive environment to be able to promote sort of healthy lending in a healthy housing market, right? You can eliminate sort of the most abusive products and then get down to sort of, an acceptable foreclosure rate without necessarily excluding borrowers who would otherwise be qualified from access to credit.
What's interesting about this, we've used the term unprecedented, which really has a dual meaning. It means that what we did before made sense. We didn't have one of these events. So prior to 2000, whatever we did, all we have to do is go back and do that. I mean, I'm a simpleton. To me, that's what that means.
Well, and if we look at the data, we actually find that in terms of expansion of homeownership rates and expansion of homeownership rates for particularly for the groups that, you know, I really care about, which are lower income and minority households, we actually saw homeownership rates for them expand more during the early 1990 periods than we did in 2003, 2004 onwards. The subprime boom actually helped to reduce the homeownership rate among those groups. And so sort of that riskiest lending did nothing to sort of expand access to opportunity in the way we would like it to.
And there were probably a lot of laws. I'm not as familiar with it as you would be, but in the probably 80s and 90s, there was a lot of attention paid to making sure that we don't restrict lending on purpose, redlining and that type of thing. Is that correct?
That's right.
So that would have increased the ownership rate.
And the provision of affordable homeownership programs that offered borrowers with, you know, lower incomes and lower wealth the ability to access homeownership, but through a mortgage that was, you know, a 30-year fixed rate mortgage, you know, with reasonable monthly payments that were well within the borrower's ability to repay that loan over the long term.
Isn't the whole, virtually the whole state of California now an affordable program?
Well, you would think that, but actually, you know, in relationship to people's incomes, house prices in California still do remain high. It's definitely become more affordable in certain areas, and Inland Empire and Central Valley are certainly some among the hardest hit in the country in that regard. But, you know, we have to remember that over that late 1990, early 2000s time period, house prices, you know, were so far above anybody's, you know, annual growth in terms of their incomes.
Oh, sure.
That we're not even actually at sort of, you know, stable levels yet.
Well, I would agree with that in price, but not on payment. Because you combine a median price decline of 600 to below 3 and an interest rate decline to 4%, that monthly payment that emerges is very often less than rent.
That's true. I hadn't considered the interest rate.
Yeah, and you have to. I'll give you an example. In Lancaster, there's a report produced by Cal Poly Pomona that's actually a really good report for people that do research, because it's not median price or Case-Shiller. They actually have taken the time to appraise, I'll say, 1,000 California properties every 6 months for decades. So it's literally this house appraised in 1970 for this and in 2011 for this. And that's pretty neat, because you can go backwards and see the price increase or decrease. And what I did is I took Lancaster, Palmdale, which is certainly one of the hardest hit areas, and I took the compilation of properties, and over the 20-year period from 1990, this group of properties lost 11% in real value. But interest rates in 1990 were 10%. So if you're a buyer in 2011, you get an 11% price discount. You get a 60% interest discount, and you're making more money in the area. The payment that emerges for that buyer is 29 cents on the dollar of the equivalent in 1990. So that's what I'm saying. This is the all-time monthly sale for ownership, and you have to consider interest rate, because it's probably the biggest piece and one of the most economically beneficial for people that have lower income or are just beginning, because it locks in their housing cost at fixed rate for a long time. And I think that's one of the things that we're missing the boat, and I'm sure you've done your research. One of the things you didn't point out on purpose was the need for a down payment making a very big difference in the outcome of the loan. The best performing loan probably for the last 40 years is a VA no down loan. The best payment history, the least damage for foreclosure. And I think it would be a perfect time, and this would kind of help the group that you've done so much study for, is the people that don't have a down payment, but the payment they can afford. I think they should have a nothing down loan program right now. I don't think there would be any harm in it, and I think it would be very successful.
Yeah, I think, and we would agree. Like, there isn't down payment matters somewhat, but we find that it doesn't necessarily explain foreclosures to the extent that some people would say it does. Right?
No,
like, I think.
You know what, Carolina? We're running out of time. We've got one more segment though, so can we pick this up in the next segment? We've been talking with Carolina Reed, And she is with the Center for Responsible Lending.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.